Hello? Is anyone out there? Sounds good. Very good. Thank you. That's what I was waiting for. Good evening. Thank you for coming out to what is bound to be a wonderful evening. I'm Mark Brazidis. I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program here at WVU. I'm also an associate professor of English, and on behalf of my colleagues in the Department of English, including the chair, Donald Hall, the associate chair, Tim Sweet, the director for the Center for Writing Excellence, Gorbury, and many, many others, and my colleagues in creative writing, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Marianne Salmon, Ethel Morgan Smith, and Alyssa High. I could go on with my family or something, but let's stop there. We're really glad you're here, and we're really glad Randall Keenan is here to read to us tonight. Before we get to the reading, I want to say, first of all, that there is a bookstore here. It's just outside, which I'm not accustomed to, so if you leave and take a left turn, Randall's books are available out there, so you'll want to be sure to check that out after the reading. And what we have going on tonight is the Sturm Writer in Residence reading, one of the highlights, if not the highlight of our reading season. And along with this fabulous reading, Randall will conduct a workshop with 12 lucky students, 10 graduate students and 2 undergraduate students here at WVU over the next 3 days, reading their nonfiction and fiction, talking about it, and much more. And I wanted to announce who those students are, and if you would stand up and we can give them applause at the end of reading of the names. So, Justin Anderson, Eric Cipriani, Sarah Einstein, Heather Fries, Alyssa Hoffman, Hannah McPherson, Connie Pan, Rebecca Schwab, Rebecca Thomas, Jeremiah Scheller, Shane Stricker, Christina Wolf. And we also have the winner of our Sturm Scholarship, which goes to an outstanding undergraduate in the creative writing concentration who's also an English major. And this year's winner, and the scholarship comes with a prize of $1,000, so no small thing. And that's Kimberly Knowles. Kimberly? Kimberly? I think that's all I have to do. I get to introduce the introducer tonight, and that is our own wonderful Ethel Morgan Smith.
Thank you. I did everything that Mark said, especially the part about Halloween. Thank you for coming out, everybody. As student, our writing community, and especially thanks to Mark and all the members of the Creative Writing Committee, Department of English, and especially the staff who worked on so hard. It's such a pleasure for me to introduce Randall Keenan, our 2011 Virginia Butt Stern resident. He has held teaching positions at Sarah Lawrence, Columbia, Duke University, University of Mississippi, University of Memphis, and of course the University of North Carolina Chapel of Columbia. Whatever I say to you is going to be abbreviated. I could stand here and talk to you probably as long as this talk about his accomplishments. So, Randall is the recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship, a White and Writers Award, the Sherwood Anderson Award, and the 1997 Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. This is just the name of you. His debut novel, A Visitation of the Spirits, was published in 1989, and this is what one reviewer said. Even though this novel is more than 20 years old, its currency is likely to be questioned for many years, not likely to be questioned for many years to come. Penn gives readers a peek into a rural North Carolina town, very much like the one he was raised in. Another reader stated, "When I read the last page of this book, I turned back to the beginning and started over. I have never read a book that so profoundly moved me." I'm sure many of us felt the same way, and if you haven't, you will. Other reviewers use such language as stunning, underrated writer, insightful view of a rural community life. Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, with this collection of short stories, which was published in 1992, was nominated for the Los Angeles Times Book Award for Fiction, was a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle Award, and was among the New York Times notable books of 1992. This work shows enormous, talented prose stylist. Randall brings together the best qualities of James Baldwin, Constance McCullough, Toni Morrison, and Randall O'Connor. Higher praise would not be better. Another reader said, "From the first story to the last, my favorite, a mesmerizing tale about a former slave who achieves a mythic quality to his life." This collection of stories is brilliant. It is consistently inventive, intelligent, and a passionate account of the fantastic, mythical, ordinary lives of a small southern town. "Keep writing, Mr. Penn," she said. "I, for one, await a follow-up to that book." A follow-up came, not just that book, but many books. "The Fire This Time mesmerized my nonfiction workshop class last semester, as Let the Dead Bury Their Dead did for my graduate class in 2005. I have been receiving emails all day from some of those graduate students who are very jealous, but they're not, and as they should be. The Fire This Time is an inventive writer who continues James Baldwin's legendary tradition of telling it on the mountain by giving a voice to the unfurnished truth about that. Kennan demands attention. He often thinks his food rather than to write. One feels more a listener than a reader, drawing a chair up to the spot. Kennan presents a magnificent view of what it means to be human, filled with insight and wisdom and provocation, a call for hope, celebration. We want to celebrate you tonight, Lionel Glass, representing you from West Virginia. Please join me in doing so.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me here. It is an honor and a privilege. And I've been through West Virginia. It's the longest I've been in West Virginia. I look forward to it. And to some old friends and new friends, and I hope future friends. I'm going to read a story. It's not that old. The title comes from a song. I'm increasingly fascinated by what Greil Marcus calls the songs of the old weird America, that period after the Civil War, all the way up to Edison's invention, and just before World War II, a lot of them got recorded. And if you know the Harry Smith anthology, you find some of them there. But they are very weird, only American. But a lot of the songs we know. We don't know who wrote them. And I just love a lot of them. And sometimes they'll say that the person who recorded it is the author, but no, it's not floating underneath it. And one of them, a lot of people think Elvis Presley wrote this, but Johnny Cash recorded it, and Odetta recorded it. Run on for a long time, children. Run on for a long time. I bet you got a mic, I'll cut you down. There's a verse down. Good God, everybody, let me tell you the news. My mind was wet with the midnight dews. I was down on a bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. My Lord spoke, and he spoke so sweet. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels. That was love, that phrase. crane's flesh, or the shuffle of an angel's wing. And you don't know where he is, but you can hear it. So that's the title of this story. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels. Goddamn Lexus. It was Jackson's car, not Cicero's style. Too big, too expensive, too much of a statement. Jackson had been all about statements. His life was a statement, as had been his death. Now Cicero Cross sat in a dead luxury car in the middle of York County on a gravel road watching the rain come tumbling down. This storm was like the storm Cicero remembered from his youth. Great late afternoon deluges accompanied by a preternatural darkness. Great crashes of lightning. Nature's resounding timpani of thunder. The room of his grandmother saying, "Hush now, boy, God's talking." He was actually shocked when his cell phone got a signal. This being down east North Carolina where you got no reception 50% of the time. This being one of those perfect movie moments when our hero runs out of options, his back against the wall, caught out in the rain, and here comes the monster. The nice Mumbai voice at AAA, so machine pleasant, unhurried, empathetic, full of godless cheer, told him a truck was on the way and would be there to pick him up in 45 minutes to an hour, maybe a little longer. Cicero felt a bit miffed that it would take so long, then relaxed into that sense of release, no longer in his hands. Help is on the way. He regretted that he couldn't listen to the radio. 500 specialty stations beamed down with Arthur C. Clarke-blessed electromagnetism, blanketing the planet. A perfect time to listen to All Sinatra, or All Sly and the Family Stone, or All Barbara Walters. With only the pelting of H2O in his thoughts, his guilt to keep it pumping. At least it's not midwinter. Fucking goddamn Lexus. The lights appeared surprisingly soon. In less than 20 minutes, a dark figure, rather hulking, swung out and down from the high door with simian agility. And Cicero got out in the rain to meet his savior. The rain was just mizzle now, faint and soft. He could smell the cornfield to his left and the cotton field to his right. "Hey, boy," Tommy said. "Tony, that you? Ah, well, damn." Tony Carter reached out his great paw, calloused and hard. "Been a while, ain't it? Am I glad to see you. This damn car just shut down on me. Can't get a peep out of it. Let's hook her up and take her in and we'll see about getting you on the road." Cicero stood back and watched his old high school classmate. How long had it been? 15 years? 20 years? Tony Carter maneuvered the high and wide wrecker, backing it up in front of the car, lowering the mechanism, chaining the wheel slowly, deliberately lifting the overpriced hunk of glass and steel and chrome and rubber up like a casket. Tony had been a big guy back in the day. Now he was huge, heavy set, but as they say, he wore it well. He still moved with the grace of the athlete he once was, and still had that reserve which made his stillness, in contrast to his speed, disquieting and thrilling. "Go ahead and get the truck, man. We're about ready to roll." In the cab of the truck, Tony stopped before he started down the road and beamed at Cicero, full face, the way a relative looks at a soldier home from a war. "Good to see you, bro." "His uncle said Cicero wanted to sell his land. He was right. But not for the reasons Dax Cross thought." "Boy, you ain't selling shit. If you and Tisha Ann agree to sell that land after I'm dead and gone, then you won't have my blessing. But you'll be free to. But I'll be goddamned if I let you sell it while I got breath in my body." the coffin commenced, red-eyed and gloomy. Zach's cross was now so emaciated and ashen, his cough sternly wrapping his body. The smells that wafted up and down the halls of the Seraphim Care nursing home reminded Cicero of his grandmother. Liniment oil, the same brand, no doubt, perhaps, but there were all other smells, the antiseptic kind, the all-too-human kind, the smell of cafeteria carrots and Salisbury steak, instant mashed potatoes, beans, and jello, served in styrofoam boxes for those too weak to hobble down the hall, like his uncle, who no longer had the heart to battle with his wheelchair. The lack of a leg made that fight a done deal. 100 acres left. 100. I inherited that from my granddaddy, and he inherited it from his daddy. Got another 50 acres from Ruth Esther. Hated to sell that, and told myself. His uncle had been repeating the story to Cicero for over a year now, from when he and his cousin Tisha Ann decided that after the amputation that Dax Cross couldn't stay at home any longer. Dax fought the idea even when it became apparent, even to him, that the cost of completely refurbishing the 80-year-old house he had they had all grown up in and accustomed to refit the bathroom, the ramps, the lights, even with the government assistance, would be too expensive. It just made sense. Tisha Ann agreed. For all the 47 years of Cicero's life, Dax Cross had been the firm but cheerful older man, philosophical, even tempered. In fact, Cicero could not remember his uncle ever raising his voice, except when Cicero was a boy and had done something extraordinarily foolhardy, like let the dog into the chicken coop or left the refrigerator door open wide all night. But for the last year, he had become a constant screaming, yelling, cussing, fiery pain. It was as if diabetes had stolen not only his leg, but his sense of himself. Instead of sadness, Dax Cross seemed to only experience anger. I got my honor pension. I got my teacher's pension. I got my TIAA crap. I'll be damned if I'm going to sell that land. You can keep the house, Dax, but my black ass, you fucking Nazi faggot. Get the hell out of here. Go, I'm sick of looking at you, you fucking asshole. Talk about selling my land. Uncle Dax, get the fuck out, I said. The nurse, the gentle-faced white lady, her hair in a stylish brush cut, who seemed not in the least pain to intervene, placed her hand on Cicero's shoulder. You better let your uncle rest now, son.
He's been having trouble resting. Ain't that right, Mr. Cross?
Dax leered at the woman, combination vampire and werewolf. I am not a child. Don't talk to me like I'm some fucking baby.
Language,
Mr. Cross. Oh, I'll spank you. She gave an ineffectual and out-of-place giggle. Okay, Dax, I'm going to go now. I need to get back to Washington.
Yeah, right.
The nurse walked Cicero to the front door. She gave him warm and fuzzy platitudes about how the loss of mobility can make amputees feel helpless and defensive, how worsening blood sugar levels can affect the emotion of severe diabetics. Cicero had heard it all before, and in truth felt no guilt over what he had to do, but that did not make him feel guilty. Jerome Harbinson wasn't a dot-com billionaire, as non-business reporters sometimes misidentified him. He had made his money in telephony software, especially in a series of programs that revolutionized wireless communications. The baby bells doted on him the way the wise man doted on the Jesus child, the Christ child. And then after he had semi-retired at the tender age of 29, selling his first hatchling for an amount of money that could sustain a small country for a couple of years. He went into the gaming industry with the lust of a teenager after a Playboy model. Now he wanted R plus C squared to build his tomb. He was 36, and as far as anybody knew, as healthy as a sperm whale. Rather than one big house, Jerome Harbison's estate, situated just north of Sonoma Valley, was a compound, five houses of vaguely Japanese 12th century design. His true extravagance and passion was reserved for the grounds. Zen through and through. Zen rock gardens, Zen fountains, Zen bridges. Too much Zen, if you ask Cicero, especially considering that A, Jerome Harbison had no visible religion, having run a punk church in a Cleveland suburb, and was now ostensibly agnostic or even atheist, but certainly not Buddhist. And B, there really wasn't any such thing as Zen architecture or Zen design. It was the sort of excess in moderation that made Cicero's teeth clench. Jerome Harbison had read about Jackson and Fortune a year before he died. It had been the image of the church in Eatonville, Florida, that captured J.H.'s imagination. It felt, he told Jackson, kind of zen. He had said to himself that day, J.H. did, that this is the man who will build my mausoleum. Jackson lived to take the piss out of men like Jerome Harbison, and the fact that he was dying made the assignment that much richer. Normally, R plus C squared work turned down celebrity work. Or at least Jackson had. A few rich and famous souls had enticed him by tacking on worthy projects, footing worthy bills. He suckered one Southern Belle superstar in building an entire orphanage in Pinpoint, Georgia, in exchange for the design of a guest house that nobody would ever see. But she had bragging rights. The sicker Jackson got, the more perverse he became about such deals. Maybe you just need to tell that man no, Cicero had told his lover. Why? He has promised to endow a school right here in Washington, no? This is good, no? Of course. He's a big man, a very big man. The rue that crossed Jackson's face had grown less mischievous and more hatred as he grew weaker than ever. His great frame even more skeletal. He wants a great lasting monument to mark his inconsequential life. No, so be it. He can afford it. No, besides, he is so cute. I love to look upon his lovely, pure face when he sounds such a bitch. Jackson Ribeiro didn't know a damn thing about capoeira until he, as a high school student in Vermont, witnessed a traveling troupe in Stowe. Rippling, multi-hued, stallion-like bodies, flipping, kicking, soaring, bending, the lyricism of manliness, the prosody of testosterone abound, the dance of the Brazilian soul. He had felt an expatriate's true pride for the first time. He was hooked. But the myth that he had learned it as a boy in the streets of Rio de Janeiro was one of those legends he allowed to blossom, even when he set the record straight in his memoir, From Pichot with Love. The idea persisted, seemed to cling to his massive body as if the muscles and smile and jewels spoke their own truth. Reality be damned. They had known each other as undergraduates, but it not dated. Cicero knew of Jackson, everybody did. Jackson was ashamed to admit later that he did not remember Cicero when they were reunited almost 10 years after they had graduated. Back in their Howard University days, he had been much too busy, already a social butterfly, a force of nature, a legend in the making, 6'6" of beige Portuguese accented brawn, the Brazilian wunderkind. He moved like a dancer, he spoke like a poet, and Americans are suckers for accents. Born with the world of born for the world of design. Even as an undergraduate, he had developed his own style, the colorful African fabrics that he wound around his sinewy frame like royal raiment, the jewelry, which on a man even slightly less Herculean would have made him look like a drag queen. But on Jackson Ribeiro appeared not only regal but somehow manly, shaved head, nose ring, gleaming white teeth, eyes dark as caverns. He never slept alone. Cicero joined the crowd of all those who pined after the majestic grizzly. I hear he's dating that guy from that TV show. You know the one. Oh, really? I heard him sleeping with that movie actress. Oh, I saw him with the son of the ambassador from Brunei. They were like this. Seriously. Famously, the wretched child of the wretched streets of indifferent Rio de Janeiro, famously abandoned by his father, famously not knowing who his mother had been, famously selling his body and stealing to survive, famously encountering a Catholic priest on a mission to save the youth of Brazil, famously spirited away to New England at the volatile age of 14, famously taken in by a retired physicist and his high school guidance counselor wife, famously becoming a giant at 17, famously gay, famously brilliant, famously ambitious, famously gifted in self-promotion. 10 years, Cicero went on to get an MS in structural engineering, but found designing oil derricks and superstores and factories to be a dull thing. When his cousin invited him to join her architectural firm, he found he reveled in architectural school, in the history of building and design, in houseness, in beauty and philosophy of edifice, and was delighted to become the second C in C plus C, cross and cross architects. But it was his cousin Isidore's idea to link up with this up-and-coming architect who was winning awards, setting new standards, and causing such a stir in his exotic postmodern blends of Arab and Spanish and Southern American designs. His cutting-edge use of technology, found materials, and social and environmental consciousness, an architect of times. With such a dazzling showman to boot. Already, his name was included in the same sentences as Gary Johnson Mockbee. In Promise Incarnate, Jackson Ribeiro, yeah, we went to school together. Isidora had worked with Jackson when he first got out of architectural school in a large Chicago firm where he first made his bones. She marveled at his panache, his verve, his inventiveness, and dash, and chutzpah, in disregard of the status quo. They had remained friends. But of course, he'd be following Jackson's career from afar, one of those benchmarks one uses to measure one's own life. 33, are you happy? Is this all there is? Two long relationships with a dutiful doctor, a patient music teacher, had left Cicero wary of matters of the heart. Isidore's eager suggestion meant nothing to him, other than the sure understanding that he would be needed for his knowledge of stress fractures and balance loads, and not for his deep appreciation for Florentine design in the 15th century. Has Atlas shrugged yet? It was the first thing Jackson said to him that day. He came into the office, dressed like a Mauritian Bedouin. Hooded in indigo silks as lush as a pasha's, his gold and platinum bracelets jangling, turquoise and lapis lazuli rings sparkling. As he shook Cicero's hand, that damn smile. Fucker. Distributed cap. That was it. Pretty simple to fix. Tony owned a mechanic shop now, had for the last 15 years. They sat in the cluttered, grease-bespattered, dusty office and drank instant coffee and reminisced in the way only fellow time travelers could do, having commenced their journey at the same instant in history, feeling the same tick at the same time. So remember that time Ms. Brown found that cockroach in a vest in a pocketbook and peed himself right there in class? Remember Greg Thomas and that time he fell out of the second story window? That's full. Where is he now? You heard about Tammy Johnson. Miss Edgar, the math teacher, yelled a wreck about 5 years ago. The very stuff of opportunities, the currency of middle age and growing older, yet a balm to the creeping sense of grayness. Shared palaces of mutual settled destruction. So I've been hearing all about you, man, doing good, seeing the pictures of that building you built over in, where was it, Saudi Arabia? Dubai, actually. Tony laughed, and Cicero was amazed at how much his guffaw sounded like a young jockey knew, had known. Shit, do fucking buy! That's all right, man! He raised his hand for a high five. Man, this coffee is worse than dog piss. Want something stronger? Well, you know I was planning to drive back tonight. Tony didn't heed Cicero's half-hearted objection and retrieved from a file cabinet an unopened bottle of Canadian Mist whiskey. He took down two dusty plastic cups from over the desk and gave a boyish wink as he poured them both two fingers each. Come on, motherfucker, drink up! I'm enjoying myself now. I know you can handle your liquor fancy pants. If you want, you can crash at my place and leave early in the morning. One drink led to five. The clock on the wall read 12:03. Histories had been recounted, but more of the distant past had been reheated than the more recent vintage. Tony's marriage. Yeah, I married Tony Walford. Yeah, I know. Too damn cute for words. Tony and Tony. I got sick of that shit by the end of the first week. Tony's children. Can you believe I got a girl who graduated college, one who's a freshman at State, another who's going to Spelman in the fall? Who's the old fucking owl? Tony's divorce. Just got bored, man. That's the only way I can put it. Make sense of it. After one of those pauses, the seventh of the 7 minute lulls that attends all conversations, Tony said, sorry to hear about your man. That was rough. Just Ann said, you all broke up about it. And all. My condolences. For the first time that evening, Cicero was confronted by the fact that he had not spoken much at all about his life outside of his professional achievements, about the so-called movers and shakers he had met, and he had not acknowledged the fact of his queerdom and of his life with the rather famous gay man. Thanks, man. They raised their plastic cups to Jackson, who Cicero thought in an oblique way was responsible for this reunion. He won't go, Cicero. Tish Ann had been the rock of the family. Cicero had watched her go from tomboy to small-town beauty queen, to wife of a local used car dealer, to mother of three. From scrawny girl child to matriarch, he marveled and trembled a little. Time was not a winged chariot, it was a space shuttle, a battle star. I just spoke with him yesterday, Tish. I mean, how long can he keep this up? I've already sent the check. They're expecting him next week. You tell him that then. I did. The true guilt he felt was that he had heard the sorrow in his cousin's voice. She seemed to manifest her concern more palpably, more achingly, than he could approach. When he spoke with her, she, who had been on hand to watch her father's health decline, to watch the diabetes ravage his once strong body, to see him wheelchair-bound. Cicero somehow wanted to tap into that sense of empathy, that feeling of betrayal, to be able to put himself in his uncle's place and understand the outrage of what they were asking. But Cicero was an engineer. He thought in terms of quantities and spatial relationships and mathematical solutions. Or that's the excuse he gave himself. You're going to have to come down here, man. I can't do it. I'm sorry. Jackson had been dead for only a few months at that time. Cicero was dwelling, not really living, in Too Much House on the north side, North Shore, Maryland. A comfortable drive into the D.C. office. He did not want to go. He wanted to tell him to instruct her fat husband to do it. But Roger was afraid of that, and had been even before he married Sisha Ann. That trip was the first time he took Jackson's behemoth instead of his trusty Honda. At least he'd be comfortable in driving to his discomfort. Cicero had expected pyrotechnics and yelling and screaming, demonic ravings, cursing, disownments. He actually asked the Reverend Lazarus Barden to stop by in the event that his uncle came totally unhinged. But that cross said not a mumbling word, though his eyes communicated boxes and hexes that should have turned his nephew into stone. This Korean War veteran, this high school social studies teacher, this vice principal, this single parent too, this trustee of First Baptist Church, this man who had taken in his late sister's boy as his own, now one-legged and rolling out of the only home he'd ever known, ancestral fruit tree surrounded, lushly cared for and tended and mended over the years, now ushered into the anteroom of the great undiscovered country. Not so great. The meeting at the nursing home was pro forma, and as they went through the motions, it felt to Cicero as if he'd done this before, seen it done. Dull industrial carpet, functional though boring furniture, wood and cheap chrome and stain-resistant upholstery, of the freshly painted serge brown walls, framed portraits of kittens and puppy dogs and baby pigs, biblical quotations, positive affirmation from dead gurus of life. The administrator, the wife of a cousin, coiffured and dressed as if she were going to a nightclub, almost rushed through her instructions, her reassurances, and all the while his uncle remained stone, crossed his arms, a sphinx. They tucked him in bed, the orderly having lifted the once 200-pound man, farmer and football coach, like a sack of flour. Okay, Dax, I'll call you when I get home to see if the number works. Go to hell. The first and last thing Dax had said to him there. That night in Tony's house, a rather large and comfortable couch, Cicero tossed about, not able to sleep, his mind sizzling with the visit, with his uncle, with his past and upcoming meeting with Jerome Harbinson, with Tisha Ann, with the Dan Lexus, with the prospect of a firm offer for his family's land with the Terrell Corporation, with the abiding grief over dead Jackson that felt like background radiation with the half-life of uranium-238. Not going anywhere anytime soon, with Tony and the memory of Tony then and now, that hug just before bed, very tight, lingering a bit too long, two middle-aged men with more than a few unnecessary bulges poking out of their once sleek bodies, alone together in the wee quiet of the morning, a brushing of lips against the side of the cheek, tests my imagination. The song, annoying as hell, by the Temptation, it's kept playing over and over again in his mind. It was just my imagination. Running away from me. He'd known Tony since kindergarten. He had been like the buildings of his childhood, just there. They were tight friends this year, rarely spoke the next. He saw Tony here and there at church, at Bible, vacation Bible school, or field trips. They traded comic books. They played basketball sometimes. Sometimes they'd sit together at the Caswell cafeteria and trade in the latest innocuous gossip about who was doing whom, about TV shows, about Carolina versus State basketball. The thought that truly bothered Cicero was that picking up some true sexual tension between us back in the truck, between sips of whiskey on the drive back home in the hub of our ballistic chest. He had not thought about Tommy in over a decade. When he visited home, he spent most of his time with his family. Tony was not a churchgoer. His name had simply not come up in conversation just once, only once. One of those dread, hormone-filled, adolescent, penis-driven, oh-so-happy happenstances. The junior year in high school, Cicero's only claim to athletic fame was running. He ran the mile. Tony did the 50-yard dash. That day, a track meet in Wilmington at Hoggard High School, they both set school records. Cicero hitched a ride with Tony back home. Was it the spring air, the azaleas and the pollen, and the fragrance of fresh-cut grass, the high of success, the mutual intoxication of sweat and naked thighs, the unstoppable sense of maleness, unstoppable maleness. Tony's hand between his legs, his between Tony's, both taboo and Christmas. And that look, and that question, you want to stop for a while. The act had not lasted long. Twitches and twinges and pulses and involuntary spasm, gasp, a sigh. And yet it felt like time inside a beloved song with no grace note at the end that lingers and lingers on, that continues to vibrate well after the orgasm, well after the panting is done. Cicero continued to fret and noticed that the sun was beginning to rise, and in his fretting, should I go into his room? No, that would be a huge mistake. In his indecision and confusion and remembrance of things adolescent, realized that not only had he forgotten all the burdens of the last few months, but that he was feeling teetotaciously alive. That he was sensing a fresh and old stirring that he somehow bid adieu with Jackson's death, even before Jackson had gone. The temptations kept on playing in his mind, and he did not mind at all. He loved the temptations.
I don't know, Mr. Cross. I'm not, well, let's see if I can express what I'm feeling, what I see. I'm wondering, you see, if Jackson was right. Jerome Harbison did look exceptionally cute when he was starting bullshit. Somehow, Cicero had talked the young gazillionaire into going through with the construction of his monument at the tender age of 37. Perhaps the death of Jackson made J.H. value the project even more than his doubts over the design. Jackson had designed for his tomb an adobe shack, built from real adobe bricks imported from Mexico. Cherry trees and cedar and lotuses afloat in storybook ponds, footbridges over trickling streams, patterned raked pebbles whose contours bespoke Kamakura peace and warlords long dead, and Prince Buddha's promise, tranquil, yes, but then just expensive. I'm feeling Aztec, you know, some deep techno-Chilean roots. I'm really digging it. I mean, wow, but Mr. Cross, I'm saying this with respect. I don't mean to sound shallow, and I know how intensely spiritual and intelligent and spiritual Mr. Ramiro was, but Mr. Kanji, does it work? I mean, with the rest of the place, I mean, it didn't take an editor of Architectural Digest to see what was making Harbison so uncomfortable, and for a moment Cicero felt bad for Jerome Harbison, knowing full well that by and by the kid would get over his reverence for the dead and over the fear of his own death, then tear down the joke built at his expense.
Maybe he'd realize that a dead man had used him for a final chore. Maybe he would not. In either case, Cicero no longer found it funny. Mr. Harbison, reconstruction, seeing it for the first time, can be shocking. You should live with it for a time before making any rash decisions. Harbison stood still and gazed at Cicero as if trying to figure out this idea of living with something. As if wondering how much time one let pass before enough living was done. As if wondering if this was his way out, that he could erase this many $100,000 mistake of his life, like next year's tax write-off. You should know that the steel beams, you see, Cicero pointed out, a cage that held the ancient bricks in place like an ornate cage. Its design clearly inspired by Napoleon III period of Mexican colonialism. The material will, over time, oxidize in an amazing way. The color will deepen, and the orange steel will turn a moody, deep, rich purple. I'm not sure if I've made that clear. Of course, Mr. Cross. Thank you for reminding me. J.H. paused and blinked at the eyesore, trying not to grimace, and failing. You know, my favorite look. Cicero sighed and turned to leave. No, Mr. Harbison, actually, my favorite look much worse. As far as Cicero was concerned, hospice care workers were angels walking upon the earth. His admiration for them would never dim. Jackson's death, like all his life, had been something of a production. The house in Maryland had not long been finished when he had become bedridden. Visitors were legion, taking the trek to the Chesapeake Bay to pay their respects, disco music, and reggae, and bossa nova. Too much bossa nova, you think? Give me sad, give me happy, no? Maybe more time, maybe. Give me four thoughts, no? Resounded throughout the house, that's on the state-of-the-art resound system. 10 tumultuous years, and it had not been bliss, but mostly happy, usually fun, always interesting. He had known Jackson was seropositive the first night. He climbed into bed with him. It never once occurred to Cicero not to take the Brazilian giant into his arms, into his heart, his funny valentine. The house on the Maryland shore had been like their child, two redoubtable architects conceiving together. Ground up, 9 years in the making, insanely large, insanely eclectic, bordering on bad taste. Da Vinci's Florence meets Ramesses' Memphis, meets the huts of Congo, temples of Indonesia. But they pulled it off, and damn near went broke in doing it. The Casa Mala de Grimm, winning awards, was a bet. Even when awards was a foregone conclusion. I shall die here, Jackson had said on the night they spent on the bare land after they had purchased it. Frisky amid brush and weeds and bugs and dirt. That was the last time Cicero had allowed himself to sob, and they were actually tears of joy. In compromise with HIV, were living for decades now. The presaged death actually felt as far away to him as did his own. Jackson died after lunch one overcast May day, when war was imminent in big, wide America, as a lot had largely forgotten about acquired immune deficiency syndrome. While taking a nap on the deck overlooking the Chesapeake Bay, after having a lightly spicy gazpacho and a few salty crackers, as much as he could hold down by that time. He had, of course, written out his funeral in the last detail. Washington National Cathedral, the Harlem Boys Choir, Jesse Norman, Memorial Capoeira Dance. For Cicero, the most disquieting moment was back in the house with Jackson's adopted parents, now in their 70s, simply bewildered, unprepared. He was the strongest man I'd ever met,
Professor Ross Coffey said.
Cicero woke to the smell of eggs and bacon and coffee, the real kind this time, and toast and grits. Lovely grits, precious grits. How sweet the taste. Shirtless, Tony's beefy brown brawn was no less alluring than his teenage scimitar tawny form. And he could cook, too. Damn. Hope my guess that I hijacked you last night. Was just happy to see you, bro. For a while, they munched and spoke of random things. Nothing like the intense rehashing of history undergone the night before. This was light. This was baby warm. Finally, you taking many meds? Meds? You know, for Cicero had never been what is commonly known as a morning person. He hated to think at this hour. But Tony's meaning became clearer. I'm clean. Tony did not look at him. I'm sorry. Nothing to be sorry about, man. It's all good. Tony sopped up the last of his grits with the last remnants of his toast. He chewed. Yeah, he said, 7 years from me. Cicero just stared at him, coffee cup suspended at a ridiculous angle he would later think, as he replayed and replayed and replayed this moment in his mind's eye, seeing his old buddy as if it were for the first time that morning in the bright April North Carolina light that streamed through the lemon curtains like a children's dream. Oh, the coffee was now warm. Damn, man, sorry. Cicero finally managed to squeeze out his toes. They felt numb all of a sudden. You remember Mr. Thompson? Tony was looking at him now and smiling with that same sweet, uncomplicated openness he had had yesterday inside the truck. The algebra teacher? Track coach? Yeah, I remember him. Remember what he used to say all the time, his fucking mantra? Without pausing, they both said, "It is what it is." The unison of their laughter rang out like an out-of-tune donkey chorus for quite a few minutes. Exactly the sort of laughter that chases away evil spirits in awkward moments. Haunted dreams. Ain't but that old coot in a coon's age. Tony got up to collect dishes. You look good, no problems? Oh, no, man, I ain't been sick since I tested nothing. Haven't even had a cold or nothing. This new stuff they got. All the fucking pills, man, it's something else. Not like, yeah, I feel you. So before breakfast, he'd imagined his leave taking to have been a raucous thing. Backslapping. I'll call you when I'm in town next time. We'll finally hang, parting, half meant, half expected. But now his parting was a heavy thing, a molten thing. A thing that drug down on him like the shackles of both their ancestors. He did not hesitate to kiss Tony full on the lips, and Tony responded as if with relief. Such big, warm, lush, delicious lips they were. Tony grabbed his butt. This little rogue didn't say he called. He knew at this point words like J.H.'s, only what happened next mattered. He meant good. It wasn't enough to say you'd come back. Coming back was coming back. Cicero sat in his goddamn fucking expensive shitty luxury car, his dead lover's fucking expensive shitty Lexus, and thought, I can't leave stuff like this. He lost track of time as he sat and looked out over the cornfields, the green, so young, so struggling to take to the sky. Immature things, but too big for crows to pluck. For the engineer, the solution finally presented itself the same way quadratic equations all at once materialized before his inner eye. The simplicity, rightness. What is land? What is a building? What does a man really own? He started the car and drove back. Back to Seraphim Care Nursing Home. He sat for a long time in the chair that was a knockoff of a knockoff of a knockoff of a once fresh design by Le Corbusier, like the images on Plato's cave. Uncle Dax had taught him all about Plato. He had made him read The Republic when he was 12 and made him write a report on it. Dax Cross lay on his bed, flipping through Time magazine as if it had offended him, glancing up at C-SPAN every few minutes, playing on the television bolted to the ceiling, hanging there like laboratory equipment, waiting to be fixed. Dax ignored his nephew with admirable convincingness. After about 30 minutes of the silent treatment, Cicero said, "Okay, Uncle Dax, we won't sell the place. I'll sell the house in Maryland. Use that to pay. Well, we'll keep the land and the family." Dax spoke up quickly, as if they'd been chatting for the last half an hour. "Don't do me no favors! I thought that's what you wanted." "It is what I wanted. But I want you to understand, you knucklehead, I want you to get it. So you go ahead and do what you got to do. I'm done with your black faggoty ass. I ain't gonna forgive you. I am not pleased with you." Cicero wins. "Don't you get tired of this? This bitterness. I mean, can't you see I'm just trying to do the right thing?" Dax flipped through the magazine some more. He looked again up at the Senate hearing. Cicero wondered if he even knew he was being confirmed. "Fuck off!" Cicero turned to go. As he got to the door, he heard his uncle say, "Right thing to do anyway." Cicero wheeled around. Dax was not looking at him. He had the magazine over his face. He turned to tell you. Thank you, West Virginia.
Any spots left in that workshop, sign me up. Thank you all for coming. If you're in the workshop and you didn't pick up your complimentary copy of Fire This Time, I have them for exactly 5 minutes before I run away with them. So come see me and I'll give them to you. We have some refreshments over here. We have books for sale out in the hallway, and come talk to our wonderful leader. Thank you for being here.